Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining me wherever you may be around the world. And I have a special author interview for you today. I am interviewing fantasy author Mark Holloway, author of the Aspect Trilogy, a coming-of-age fantasy story that swept me off my feet from the very first book, as it takes some very dark turns, as we'll soon dive into a little bit. Spoiler-free, don't worry about that. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining me and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Glad to be here.
Awesome. Been wanting to discuss this trilogy for a while now, as I basically binged the three books. I think it was like a month time, which is very fast for me. I just couldn't put it down. So you really captured my imagination and like stole my heart in some cases. But that's spoiler. That's for another day. So I would like to just tell me, how did your writing career start? And apart from that, how did you come up with the idea for this trilogy?
They kind of started hand in hand, I guess. I think quite a lot of people I know that have published in the past couple of years, I started primarily during the pandemic lockdown. I found myself with an awful lot of free time where I couldn't go outside. So I'd always wanted to write a story, and I dabbled a little bit here and there, but I hadn't really put any effort into it. So during the pandemic lockdown, I found like an online writing group where I wrote a bunch of short stories to begin with to try and hone my writing skills before I wanted to write this novel. But I'd had this idea for The Soul's Aspect and the Aspect Trilogy for quite a long time. And it mostly originated from the fact that I'm a really picky fantasy reader. I read an awful lot when I was a kid, and then I slowed it down as I grew up, because I found it really hard to find a novel that I really enjoyed. And the Aspect series was me trying to write a story that I've been trying to read for a long time and trying to find, but I just couldn't. So the concept for the Aspect series came from trying to find a coming-of-age fantasy for an adult audience. So kind of like, you know, Robin Hobb's Realm of the Elderling series is kind of what I, you know, my kind of perfect fantasy, where it's a coming of age story, but it's kind of more geared towards adults in terms of, it's not hopeful, but it's very realistic in terms of the ups and downs of growing up. And it's very realistic in terms of the consequences of, chosen one kind of stories. So that's kind of what I was after, but it was quite hard to find stories like that. Because, you know, obviously most coming of age stories are geared towards young adults for obvious reasons.
That's great. Thank you for sharing. I loved Robin Hobb's Realm of the Elderling series. And now that you say it, I do see the connection. You're very character heavy driven, but you're also not nice to your characters in some instances. So I can definitely see the kind of the pulling of the strings there. So why don't we dive right into it? Because we have a lot to talk about. So you write the first book, The Soul Aspect, purely in first-person POV. Kellum is your main character. Just so you know, I love first-person POV. It's my favorite type of perspective to read. I love getting into the character's head and discovering the world as he or she is discovering it. What made you want to write this story in like first-person POV as opposed to like third-person?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I actually don't really like reading first, but ironically, I'm not the biggest fan of reading first person perspective, because I think if it's done wrong, it can be too distant in terms of the narrative. It puts a window pane between the character and the reader, which I think can sometimes be a bit frustrating when you're reading. But there have been some books where I read first person perspective, such as Robin Hobb and also Patrick Rothfuss, which it was done incredibly well. And I think for those books specifically, it was done so well because they really paid attention to the narrative voice and let the narrative voice be an extension of the character. And I think for me, particularly with The Soul's Aspect, because we're starting off with Kellum, who's very young and he's very naive to the beginning. First-person perspective, I chose that mostly because it was a way of putting blinders on the reader. The whole point of The Soul's Aspect book is that there is this twist, and there's this turn that happens towards the end, the middle, or the last third of the book. And the whole point of the first book is to put these blinders on the reader so that you experience the twists and the turns in the same way that Kellum does. And also quite nicely, you know, Kellan is very himself, very blinkered and very naive to the world around him. Having it in first person, having it so cloistered, the reader is forced to on the same journey that Kellan is without any dramatic foreshadowing. And we get like this very naive kind of worldview. The challenge with that is I think some readers will bounce off that kind of narrative style because it, you know, if you're not prepared to read that kind of narrative style, it can be quite frustrating to read, I think, sometimes, because you're like, well, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, why is he being so naive about things? But I try to write the first book from the perspective of, you know, he's 14, 15, 16, that kind of is kind of specified, but he's of that kind of age. He's had a very sheltered lifestyle. So it's quite fun in a way to write specifically from that viewpoint and try to be really blinkered from that viewpoint. But it was mostly set up around the narrative device that happens during the book, so that the impact of the soul aspect is as strong as it could possibly be for the reader who's reading it.
Yeah, I definitely got that while reading Kellan's point of view. Just the grueling things that you put him through throughout the course of the story. It definitely shook me, especially that point where you're talking about the turning point. Again, spoilers, we're not going to get into that part, but so let's dive into the plot. So Kellan is a local healer with his father. And that's something right off the bat that you don't get a lot of in fantasy, at least from books that I've read. You don't get a main character who's purely a healer. So it's something very, really fresh and something I enjoyed reading. So he's a healer with his father, Tema. So he's going around and providing medicine, doing research, doing his chores. But he suffers from seizures. It's something that he's had his entire life. He has to keep under control. And then that is until, oh, well, I should step back. And he has a friend, Eva, who they know each other their whole lives. He kind of has a crush on her, but he's afraid to tell her, like the shy boy that he is, much like myself if I was his age, to be frank. And then all that goes well until Thema from the Emperor comes in and discovers that he has magical abilities. He can touch the aspect. So the setup from there, it just keeps going and then just takes you into him going to like the academy and stuff like that. So that's the plot. That's tropes we've seen before, the basic plot. That's the tropes we've seen before. We've seen a boy with magic going to a school, but you put your own special twists on it. So talk to us a little bit about Kellan, how he was and how he's constructed in your mind and what you wanted to convey to the readers.
Yeah. So, I mean, Kellan as a character, you know, the healer part of Kellan came first, I would say. That kind of originated from kind of two areas. The first area was kind of from a narrative imperative where I thought it'd be really interesting to have a character whose primary focus was like the Hippocratic Oath, you know, do no harm. We work to help people who finds, unfortunately, that he has a very good ability to hurt people. And is forced into hurting people. And I like that dichotomy, and I like the way, you know, you can explore with that both the contradiction, but also the complementation in terms of a surgeon excising tumours and that sort of thing, and the way that he can conceptualise it as he grows older and as he deals with it in later books. But the other reason why I chose him as being a healer is that a lot of the aspect magic is very abstract, and I wanted a way to ground the character. And in my personal life, in my day job, I work in medicine and I work in drug development, et cetera. So I know quite a lot about the ins and outs of a lot of what Kellan does in terms of field medicine and him exploring creating medicines, et cetera. So it's a very comfortable area for me where I know how much I can ground it in real life and how much I can push it with magic as well. So it's a nice way of grounding an incredibly abstract kind of concept. But, you know, Kellan himself, he's kind of an amalgamation of various different coming-of-age characters that I've read. He is, by his nature, very naive to begin with, but that's a lot to do with the way he's been brought up and he's been sheltered by his father because of the seizures that he's had. He's been lived a very sheltered life. You know, that itself is a vehicle for the way he then goes on into the magic school. So he doesn't remain very naive, and I actually think by the end of where we get to throughout the other books, he becomes quite a resilient, shrewd kind of character, which is a nice kind of story arc in and of itself. But he is kind of, you know, there are very familiar tropes, as you said, especially to the very first act and the second act of the Souls aspect, but that is entirely by the nature. And again, spoilers free, we can't go into too much detail, but the whole point of the first opening act of the Souls aspect is to have something very familiar for a fantasy reader, so that when we get to the last act of the Souls aspect, you've got something to pivot off.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. I want to talk a little bit about Eva, because in the first book, she's there, but she's only there for like the first, let's say the first like 25-30% pretty much. She does pick back up in the rest of the series. Talk to me a little bit about Eva, why you wanted to introduce her here, and then kind of like, it's not really a spoiler, but bridge her off until like later books in the series. Because I enjoyed reading her very much. She was probably my favorite female character in this book.
Yes, Eva's probably one of my top three characters in the series. I really like Eva, and I really like her development. I think it was quite difficult to write, because obviously I have this main POV character who's male, who is the only voice in the Souls aspect. So by nature, that means all other characters kind of get sidetracked a little bit, because we're only in one character's head. What I didn't want to do is make any sort of romance the key defining part of the first book, because there's other stuff going off in the first book. But I wanted an introduction to Eva at the beginning, and then as we get more of Eva either at the end of the Souls Last in later books, you kind of get these touch points of her where you can bridge the gap with her own development as you see how she's changed from the first book to later books. And it's kind of, you get enough, I think, or I hope, from these touch points where you are able to bridge some of the gaps, and it kind of, you know, not only have you got Kellum's coming of age, but you've also got Eva's coming of age, because obviously she's the same age as Kellum. It's just, we just don't get to, you don't get to explore it in the same way. But what I wanted to do was kind of have someone on a parallel track to Kellum who experiences a lot of very, very similar things, but you don't see it, but you can see how it changes her as her own character. And then as we go on into later books, and we get more and more of Eva, which I also really like, that she gets much more of a voice in the later books. It helps to bridge what happened in the first book more while we're only focusing on Kellum. Yeah, but yeah, it is a challenge. It was something I was definitely thinking about in the first book, is this book too male-centric? Have I got enough female characters and making sure I'm giving female characters a voice, and that they're not just like a springboard for the main character?
Yep, excellent. And you did a great job with her. She's very caring, very loving. Her voice shines. She's like the shining beacon in the story in some aspects, but you have to read her and see for yourself. So why don't we switch to when Kellum gets to the academy? There's three schools of training in the academy. There's healing, there's destruction, and there's fabrication. I believe the building of things. Okay, yeah. That's right. And obviously, he makes friends. At the academy, so a lot of people don't like Kellum because where he comes from. We'll leave that part out to not get into that. But just getting to the academy and your kind of take on the magical training. Could you just tell the audience just a little bit about the structure of that, and then we can get into the magic system as a whole.
Sure. So the way the world is set up is that we have two different countries. We have Kasari and we have the Vinaruda. And the background to the world is the Vinaruda control and demand that any magic people, the Aspectors in this world, have to go to Vinaruda for training, to be trained by Vinaruda people as a way of maintaining power and control over the Kasari country. So Kellum goes to this magic academy, and the way that the academy is set up is you have monks who aren't magic users themselves, who train the Aspectors in different ways. And they can control the Aspectors via, so the way the Aspect works is essentially diverting energy from one source to another. And so you have to have a source of energy to be able to use the magic. And so they can give and they can take and control and limit the amount of energy that these young Aspectors have access to. So it's a very regimented way of controlling and training these Aspectors. And you have these small classes, which is a mixture of young Kasari people and young Binarudan people who are trading either in disruption, in healing, or in fabrication. And the way that the Binarudan training works is that they identify whether or not you have a particular affinity for one of these schools. It may be that you have affinity, you don't really have affinity for any of them, or maybe you have affinity for all of them, but they will force you to go down one particular school, again, as a way of controlling the Aspectors and maintaining control over the Aspectors. And the idea is once the Vinarudan monks deem you capable enough, they'll give you a permanent source of energy, which is called a tether, via a tattoo, and then you can go out into the world as a full-fledged Aspector. But until then, you get these temporary tethers, which are typically bracelets worn against the skin, and they are taken and removed, only available to you during observed training sessions.
That was a great part about reading and learning about the system. About Kellum specifically, I remember the chapter when was in front of one of the monks. I forget his name at the moment, and they're testing him. And of course, since he was a healer his entire life, he has affinity for healing, but he also has an affinity for destruction, and that's the path that they send him down. And he's learning all these, you know, destructive, we'll call them spells, more or less, for what they are. And he's doing this training, and of course there's a bully, so and that doesn't like him. And then during the trials, a lot of chaos happens. But what I liked most is that one of his friends, who we meet, Broach, he is in fabrication, and they learn that the temporary tethers, they know, when they're trying to experiment with all these different types of spells, they need to do something more. So they create like temporary tethers, or I think they're anchored to some part of the castle, to take the energy and flow it back and forth. Can you tell me about that part of the story? And also the aspect itself, like when it's pulling energy from the aspect, which is like basically all around it, it very much reminded me, I don't know if this was the influence for it, of like Star Wars, like the Force, like it's all around you, you can pull from it. Sort of thing. So I love that part.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't specifically pull it from Star Wars, although now you say it, I do recognize that, and I agree. I think it's, you know, to answer your second part of your question first, the Aspect magic system came from, I wanted something that was kind of like a blend between hard and soft magic systems, where if you really, really wanted to, and if a character was an expert enough on the Aspect, you would be able to quantify it and explain it in quite scientific terms. But in the way that the world is currently set up, you know, that just doesn't exist. And so you have this blend where some people know enough about it where they can be quite specific about the limitations of what it can and can't do. But for a lot of our characters, especially Kellum, because he's new to it, it feels more like a soft magic system because the limitations aren't particularly well understood. But it was, you know, it's essentially around the idea that if you can't create energy, can it be transferred from one source to another by this kind of invisible plane of existence called the Aspect? But I mean, the part of the book that you're talking about, you know, so the three characters we've got, kind of main characters towards the second half of the book. We've got Kellum, we've got Brock, and we've got Thane. They are trying to find a way that they can regain some sense of control within this foreign country where they are being subjected to a lot of abuse and a way of protecting themselves. And so they discover that, you know, that it is possible for them to create their own, not permanent tethers, but temporary tethers where they're able to control and source their own energy so that if they need to, for whatever reason, they would be able to practice aspecting themselves in secret or protect themselves if they ever have to. And so you've got this kind of, sub arc in the book where it's about them learning themselves and taking control of their own learning, how they can create their own temporary tethers and the jeopardy associated with that. I think the nice thing about that, like story arc itself is, that's, again, it's quite familiar if you've read a lot of coming of age stories, but the way that it's perceived for the main characters and then the way it's perceived for the antagonists is kind of totally different in terms of the consequences and the stakes that are involved. You know, for the main characters, the stakes feel quite low, but obviously for the antagonists, you discover the stakes are actually significantly higher than they were expecting it to be.
Exactly. And then the sooner, the further you get into the book, you discover that that the war that's going on has many twists and turns that you're led one. That's what I love about your writing. You lead the reader and the character down one path, and then he'll make a turn, and then boom, it's like a monkey wrench. It's like you don't even know which way is up half the time, because you put so many twists into this story that it was definitely not predictable. And I love stories that can just make my hair stand up every time I discover something brand new. One thing for new readers, just be aware, this is coming of age. It does get dark towards the end. So just keep that in mind when you pick this up, that you're in store for that. I'm not one for like trigger warnings. That's another subject. I don't know if you have two cents on it. I feel like it spoils stuff for me, or at least when I'm diving into a book. I don't know. I know authors feel like they need to do that nowadays. What are your thoughts on trigger warnings for stuff like that?
I think it depends, one, on the genre, and two, on the specific content that you're warning about. So I think if you're writing kind of like a general epic fantasy, but you cover some quite dark themes or potentially triggering themes, then I think it's fair enough to just warn readers. I think a quite nice way of doing it is at the very start of the book, just say, jump to the very last page if you want to see some trigger warnings. And then it's, you know, if you don't want to read them and don't want to be, you want to go in blind, you don't have to read them. But if you do want to read them, then they're available to you. If you're writing like a grimdark fantasy or a dark fantasy and it's marketed as such, then I think there's a bit more leeway, because there's, you know, there's expectations about certain themes which are, I mean, in Chaos Risen, the third book series, I did put some content warnings in there. And that was mostly because there are some specific themes that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see them in. I don't really market the Aspect series as a dark fantasy, but the third book is very, very dark. And so I just wanted to make sure, because they are specifically scenes that some readers may find particularly difficult if you weren't expecting to see them, I just put them in there in case anyone wanted to be aware of them. So I think if you're an author and you don't put them in, I think that's fine. I think if you're an author and you do put them in, I think that's fine. I think it really depends on the genre and the actual contents that you're trying to warn readers about. But I don't think there's a right or a wrong way of doing it. I think it's just down to personal preference, to be honest.
Yeah, fair enough. Every author is different. But to be fair, even though you do put the content warning in book three, if you've been following for books one and two, you kind of get the dark tones already, even though the third book is darker in all forms and shapes and sizes. So that's fair enough. So tell me a little bit about your writing process with writing this trilogy. Did you have the whole three-book series laid down, outline before you wrote it? Did you have just basic like mountains or like points that you need to get to? How did it all unfold? And then also, are you more of a plotter or a pantser type of speak?
It really changed and evolved through each of the books. So I think from a series perspective, I had a rough idea for the main characters. And by main characters, I mean main characters of the first book, Callum, Thane, and Brock. I had a pretty good idea of where the story started and how their stories would resolve for each of the characters. But you spoke earlier about how I lead reader down one way, but then the twists and turns, and a lot of that is because the backstory of the countries and their motivations are very crystal clear in my head. But I don't make them crystal clear within the story, because the characters are working with only snippets of information. So the overall arc of the and the history of the countries and the empires, etc., again, they're very clear in my head. And whether they eventually get explored fully or not is for later stories. But in terms of the actual within the books themselves, the souls aspect I wrote totally as a pantser, in that I had a rough idea of where the story started and where the story would end. And then I just kind of, and then split up into acts. And I was like, well, this is the start of the act and this is where the story act will end. And then I'm just going to write it in the middle. And I think that worked pretty well for the souls aspect, mostly because I've had that story in my head for like maybe 2 years, 2 or 3 years, where I've been thinking about it, conceptualizing it. And because of that, the story evolved massively as well. Like I had some like notes in notebooks from when I was originally planning out. If I look at those, it's almost unrecognizable from where it started to where it was. And a lot of that as well is because I was evolving as a writer. And there was a lot of stuff where, you know, I wrote to begin with, and then I completely changed the opening act like 3 times in the story, and then that has not an effect for later as well. The Souls Instruments, which is book 2, was a little bit more structured, and I would say that was definitely written from a plant's perspective. So again, I wasn't too I didn't plan things out too much, but I had a lot more notes about this is what's going to happen in this act, this is what's going to happen in this act. And a lot of that is because I had 2 character POVs this time. And I think what made that even more complicated for me is that, you know, I've got 2 character POVs, both of them are first person. I found it incredibly difficult to have distinct voices for both character 1 and character 2, because they are first persons. I found it myself a little bit harder to make sure that those voices felt distinct. And so to keep them separate, I did have to do more planning. But I still did write very freely with that. And then the third book, which is Chaos Risen, again, has more POVs. I'm trying to think about how many it is off the top of my head, and I can't remember, but there's more. And there is also a mixture of first person and third person. The problem I had with Chaos Risen was trying to tie all of the various threads together. And it was, you know, it was just impossible to do that from a pantser perspective, to the point where I was really struggling to find motivation to finish off the second act. And so by the time I got to like the midpoint in the book, I kind of, you know, I piled up a spreadsheet, and then I detailed each scene in each chapter that I had to write. So I ended up with like 100 lines in the spreadsheet, and then I could just tick them off and say, well, and that was a neater way for me to be able to make sure that I was able to capture all the threads I wanted to capture and entwine them in the way that I needed to entwine them, because there were a lot of sequences that needed to happen in the right order for the final final scenes in Chaos Risen to feel justified and paid off. Whether or not I'll continue to write I like that, I'm not sure. It was quite nice because I didn't have to think too much about where a scene was going to go before I write it. When I was writing the Souls Aspect and Souls Instruments, you know, when I'd sit down to write for an hour and a half, half an hour of that would be me thinking about the scene, and then an hour would be spent writing. It's a lot easier to do all the thinking ahead of time and then to just sit down and then just chuck out 2,000 words in much more condensed time. I do prefer pantser writing because I think you end up with a much more organic story, but I think that works a lot when you're writing at the very start of a book. It's a lot harder to do that at the end of the book, because otherwise you just end up with enormous stories, I think, which can end up with kind of arcs which don't go anywhere or maybe don't feel as satisfying for me personally.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about with book 2 and the 2 distinct POVs. I can see how it'd be hard to separate the two, but then it's just based on their own personal feelings and inner goals. That was just the driving force for me when reading The Souls Aspect, which I think personally, it's my favorite book in the series. I'm not sure if you've gotten feedback from fans, which ones are their favorite. That one is personally mine. Any feedback on which ones people like more than the others?
I think it's interesting because a lot of people do really like The Souls Aspect. And I think because it's quite fresh in the way that it deals with tropes and the narrative story, a lot of people, especially those who go blind, a lot of people will really enjoy The Souls Aspect. But there is also a subset of people who don't enjoy the Souls aspect for the reasons opposite that people really enjoy it, who then really enjoy the Souls instruments and then Chaos Risen. So, you know, the Souls aspect is quite a slow, very introspective, very character-driven story. And then the Souls instruments is kind of the opposite of that, where it's quite fast and it's a lot more story-driven. And then I purposely wrote Chaos Risen to be a blend of the two, so that we have some POVs which are quite slow and introspective and character focused, but then there are elements of it which are very fast paced, organized and story driven. So as a whole arc, I would hope that, you know, people who really enjoyed the Souls aspect but maybe didn't enjoy the Souls instruments as much will then come back to Chaos Risen and go, yes, this feels like a nice closure and a nice bookend to the story. And likewise, if you didn't enjoy the Souls aspect as much, but Souls instruments, you've then got something to enjoy in Chaos Risen. And to be honest, that's generally the feedback, really positive for me as kind of my very first trilogy, that, you know, the intention behind the way I wrote it has paid off. But yeah, I do think it is fair that the Souls aspect is the most popular story. And I think that a lot of that's to do with, there are a lot of tropes in there which are very familiar, and, you know, a lot of them are very comforting, and you know, the found family and the friendships and stuff, people really enjoy that. And, you know, I can totally understand that. To be honest, I think the Souls aspect is probably my favorite of the trilogy as well, for similar reasons.
Well, that's great. I enjoy both. I enjoy like the slow introspective, and then I enjoy like once you get like a big turning point, which happens towards the end of the Souls aspect, and it just compels, it flies for the rest of the series. So I enjoy both. So you mentioned this, and I saw it either on your social media handle, that this is the first trilogy. Are you planning to write another trilogy in this world? I think I heard you say something like that, or any future works, I should ask.
Yeah, so the way I'm kind of see it in my own head is that this is the first volume in the series, and I'm planning multiple volumes. So I've at least got volume 2 planned out. Whether or not there'll be a third volume after that, I'm not particularly sure. But then, you know, you can kind of see it in the same way of you know, Realm of the Elderlings, where there are distinct arcs which are closed out within each trilogy, but then there is a larger arc which takes you through to the full, to the final book in that series. The difference is, I think, is the characters and the POVs. So the main POVs may change, and they may come and go with each of the volumes, and there might be time skips, etc. But the overall story arc, I think, is pretty, you know, it's pretty clear that there will be one overall story arc. But the stakes and the kind of trilogy wide arcs will obviously be different here and there. You know, the plan for the next volume will have a few characters, more than a few characters, who were in the original trilogy, who will come back into the second volume. Whether or not there'll be main characters, side characters, or cameos, that remains to be seen as that volume gets fully planned out. But there will be opportunity for new characters to come to the forefront in each of those volumes. But I mean, you know, what I can say is the scope of the first trilogy is very large. It's enormous when you think about the stakes of the first part of trilogy. So the plan for the second trilogy is to narrow down the scope, so it's much more human-focused. And, you know, if you've read the end of Chaos Risen, you've probably got an idea about what sort of scope we're looking at for the next trilogy. So yeah, there is plans to go back into the world of the aspect. And I also have plans for smaller standalone books within the aspect, which may be novellas and take place prior to the events of the aspect, or they may take place between time skips, so that if you want to have that information as well, you can have that information. There's definitely enough within the aspect world to write quite a few more books within it.
Well, that's excellent news for all fans, and I can't wait to get my hands on those when they come out. One final question I always ask my people come on my podcast. Do you have any suggestions or reading preferences for viewers who want something a little bit more not mainstream or quote under the radar, and stuff and stories or authors you feel like should get more love than they actually have currently at the moment?
Yeah, that's a That's a good question. So I'm a really picky fantasy reader, as I already said. I've become way less well read in fantasy than I used to be. But I mean, I'm biased here, but obviously my main recommendation is to find indie and self-published authors. And the reason for that is I think traditional publishing has become incredibly risk averse in the past 5 to 10 years. So you end up with a lot of traditionally published stories, which they're not, I don't want to say boring, because I think that's got connotations, which are negative connotations, which I don't mean, but they're kind of predictable and you kind of know where they're going to go. And so if you're looking for fresh, fresh stories which feel different and they feel maybe a little bit more like earlier fantasy, which you don't see as much anymore, you really should be looking at self-publishing and indie fantasy, in my opinion. But obviously I'm very biased with that. I would also, one of the things I've been doing recently is reading slightly out of the genre. One of my favorite authors who I think is, he's become more popular recently because of the Netflix movie, but Jeff Vandermeer, who is a weird fiction author, I think a lot of the stuff he does is incredible. And not just from a story perspective, but the way he writes imagery is just fascinating. And the Southern Reach trilogy is one of my favorite books series I've ever read, just because of how different it is to everything else that's out there. But yeah, there are a lot of indie fantasy authors and indie authors as well that I think are doing incredible things as well. But to be fair, and I always say this, there are also the indie genre and self-published genre isn't immune to the issues that traditional suffers from, because there's a lower barrier of entry to it. You do have to work to find the stories, but they are definitely out there. And a lot of the time the best stories are the ones that you don't hear as much about. The ones that do get really popular, a lot of that is due to the hard work from the authors, but sometimes it can be because they have similarities to traditional stories. So if you're looking for less traditional stories, you need to be looking for the ones which have less ratings and aren't being picked up by BookTube and by popular reviewers. You do have to do some of the work and digging yourself. So that, you do have to do a lot of drawing for them, unfortunately, but they definitely exist. But yeah, I think you do have to start looking outside of traditional publishing to be able to find them. But they do exist. Things like Tenderness of Flesh, I think, is an incredible story, which again, felt very fresh to me when I read it, but it's obviously traditionally published. So looking outside of English and American publishing again is another way of finding fresher stories.
Excellent. I remember reading Annihilation from Jeff Vandermeer, and I did love it. I haven't finished a trilogy yet, but I'm very much looking forward to that. And you're right, it's harder to find self-published and indie published books out there that can relate to stuff that's come from the past. That's part of the reason why I'm doing this, is to build kind of like a small under the radar community. That's why I wanted to get you on, because I just loved your book and think more people should read it. So this has been a lot of fun, Mark. Thank you so much for coming on. Could you tell our listeners where they could find you, your social media handle, website, and where they could find the Soul Aspect?
So the Aspect in the Aspect series is primarily available on Amazon. It's available in physical copies, ebook, Kindle Unlimited, and there are audiobooks available for each one in the series, available on Audible. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, Mark Holloway, the author. I'm terrible at being active on there, but I'm more active on Instagram than I am on Twitter. But I'm always more than happy to hear from readers and to hear your thoughts and stories by DMs and have a chat. So I always love that. So yeah, so that's where you can find me. I have a newsletter if you want to stay up to date with information and news, which you can sign up to via links in my Twitter. Thank you very much for having me. This has been great.
The pleasure is all mine. And if you haven't picked up the Aspect trilogy by Mark Holloway, be sure to do it. I can't recommend it enough, especially if you want something that seems traditional and then it just takes a wicked turn that you're not expecting. So again, Mark, thank you so much for joining me, and let's do this again sometime. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, everybody.